engineering and works, 10.0. We have 10.1, trucking and bulk salt tender. Yes, Counselor Chris?
No, go ahead. I know what you're gonna ask.
So we do have a recommendation under 10.1. Who would like to move that, Counselor Hughes?
I recommend that the Council of Region Queens Municipality approve that the tender PWOA-201-2018-2019 trucking of bulk salt will be awarded to Donald Wynot Trucking Limited for the tender price of $39.75 per metric ton plus HST for the 2018-2019 winter season.
Seconded. Councilor Fisk. CAO, would you have any comment on this?
I do not. Other than we do this every year and the prices fluctuate between contractors. It's straightforward. It's picking up salt and trucking it back here.
And the recommendation is for the lowest tender offer. Councilor Johnson?
Just where do they truck it from? Bug Wash to here?
Bug Wash.
Deputy Mayor Kelly?
Just curious, do you know off the top of your head, what is our budget for salt? How much do we pay for a season or set aside for a season for salt?
Yeah. Off the top of my head.
Ballpark?
Director of Finance, Jennifer Keating Hubley, would like to get.
Okay.
How much is it, John?
45,000.
That's sort of our average.
$45,000.
It's an average over 5 years. We budget each year for an average over 5 years. You use some years to go a little over, some years to go a little less.
Yeah, okay.
Any other discussion on this issue? Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? It is unanimous. Thank you. We have nothing under 11.0 finance, nothing under 12.0 recreation and community facilities, under planning 13.0. But we do have some items, and I would ask Mr. Cloud, our director of planning, to come forward. Under 13.1, we do have the telecommunications tower met upon lane. We have a recommendation. Who would like to take the lead on this recommendation, 13.1? Councilor Johnson?
Thank you. I'd like to recommend that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality adopt an administrative policy respecting a development agreement with East Link and Donna Marie Jones to allow for the erection of a cellular telecommunication tower on property identified as PID number 7004705 and located off Meadow Pond Lane in Riverford.
Seconded for that? Councilor Fisk. Mike, would you like to give us an update on this?
Yeah, I guess just as a follow-up to the public hearing we had this morning. We've had an application from Eastlink for the erection of a new cellular telecommunication tower on a property off the end of Meadow Pond Lane in Liverpool. Under current land use regulations, under the land use bylaw and municipal planning strategy, that zone, which is the multiple use coastal residential or mixed use coastal residential R6 zone, doesn't allow for that use as of right, but allows council to consider by way of the development agreement process. So the application from Eastlink is to enter into that agreement to allow for the erection of that structure.
Councilors, have any questions or comments? Councilor Fancy?
I'd like to go back to what Mr. Whipple said this morning. It does concern me any variations of the output. It could where they start from to where they go. I wonder if we shouldn't have something, put in there, any variation of output for the tower has to be approved by council. Something where they don't get the variation to get too high of an output. We don't want long-term effect on things. Is that something we could put in, add into?
Mike, would you like to respond to that?
I think it's something that we could look at, Councillor. I know under the, I guess, the development agreement itself, Council has the ability to set out certain terms and conditions respecting the development proposal. Attached in the package is a copy of the, or attached in the public hearing package was a draft of the development
development agreement that, that was proposed. And there are certain things the council can consider under the development agreement which constitutes any substantial amendments to that development agreement. And there is potential, I guess, to incorporate a clause within that, that any substantial changes to the development agreement, that being the output beyond a certain level, be brought back as or considered as a substantial amendment, and therefore has to go back through the public hearing process.
As a clarification to that, Mike, does the CRTC regulate the amount of signal and number of signals that are placed on a tower?
It's regulated through Industry Canada, and it's federally regulated, essentially. So council can, I guess, in the development agreement process, if council was not to approve the development agreement for this site, the application still goes to Industry Canada, and Industry Canada will obviously look at what the local authority, being council, recommended. However, they're not obligated to follow council's recommendation. At the end of the day, Industry Canada is going to regulate whether a tower gets erected at that site or not. So,
yes, Councilor Fancy, follow up.
But the follow up on that is that I wouldn't be comfortable if we can't be able to have some input into that part of it. I mean, regulations are what they are today, but they can change tomorrow. And once you give somebody a full license, they don't have to come back to you. And what you're trying to say here too is that, well, if we say no, they can still do it anyway. But again, when we're talking about health and safety, I think we should be have an input in that, and I won't vote for this not unless something like that is in there.
And I understand your concern, Councilor Fancy. I think the takeaway from the discussion is that the federal government has control of what the operation of the tower actually is, and they supersede our ability. So I think the comments from our director of planning is that once the system is approved, then Ottawa regulates. Having said that, that applies to all the towers that are in Queens at this time as well. So hopefully I have captured your comments, Mike, in that of the authority of the federal government.
No, absolutely. They have the, I guess, the final authority as to.
Councilor McLeod?
Mike, I'd like to ask a question about our planning documents. Is this standard, like we have to put this in our documents, or is it elective that we can put it in our planning strategy and land use bylaws, or does every municipality have a different approach to this? And the reason I'm asking that is if Industry Canada makes the final decision, then why do we have it here? Is it because we felt we needed it in our documents for protection of our residents?
I think it allows for public input into the process by allowing it through a development agreement process. Because I think a requirement of a proponent under Industry Canada's regulations is that they consult with the local land use authority, being the municipality. So just allowing a use of telecommunication towers as of right in a particular zone, essentially a proponent would come in, and if they met the requirements of the bylaw, they got their permit. But by doing it through a development agreement process, it kicks into public engagement, where the public can come out and voice their opinions regarding the proposal. So we've actually gone beyond what is typically required in a development agreement process, whereby council has a public hearing for that development agreement. We've included provision in the planning strategy which requires a proponent to hold their own public information session prior to getting to the public hearing stage. So there's actually, for telecommunication towers, there's actually opportunities for the public to present input into the proposed development. So so I guess at the end of the day, though, regardless of if council votes in favor, fine, but if they vote against it, it's still, the application still would go through the Industry Canada for their review, and they would obviously look at what council or the local authority has say.
And it opens up a whole new interest in technology and my years with cable television and the fact that we put, you know, systems in, and is there radiation from that, and is there effects of that, and those are closer to the homes. And this is a tower that's erected, I don't know how many feet. And I mean, is there a way that these signals travel? I have no idea, none of us do, but I think it's the readings and the megahertz level and all that stuff that they're required under Industry Canada to put output.
Yeah, and that's actually regulated under Health Canada. It's referred to as Safety Code 6 under Health Canada, and they set the threshold of outputs from these, what they consider safe. So it's again federally regulated. So.
And the purpose of, if I could ask another one, the purpose of this tower then is for cell service, or was it intended for some other?
Right now, the application is strictly for cellular telecommunication towers.
Okay, and they can't piggyback on the other ones that are owned on White Point Road or on 103?
Apparently, the infrastructure that's currently in place does not meet the needs to service their customers, so that's why they're looking at erecting a new tower.
Councilor Johnson?
Well, I was wondering, within that 1,000-foot radius that we spoke about this morning, we heard two fairly well-educated people on this subject. How many actual mail-outs did we do to, how many actual residents are involved?
It actually went to a 1,500-foot radius. I guess our policy sets out 1,000-foot, but Planning Advisory Committee and Council had made a recommendation to bump that up to 1,500 feet, and I think there was 35 to 40, somewhere in that range of letters that were mailed out, personal letters, plus the notifications in the social breaker, a couple of ads for each of those, yeah.
Okay. Yes, I have Councilor Frelick next.
Lately there's been lots of talk about the environment and making better decisions for the future, and I live within that 1,000 feet. We also have a daycare, we also have a school that is in that area. And my concern is about the future and what the options are for them once it's erected and what the possibilities are for them, because we can't control that in any way. Like you said, that's someone else makes that decision. So I think there's a lot of information that is out there. It's a lot to kind of take in, but I'm not feeling very comfortable with this, so I won't be supporting this.
There was the public engagement session with Eastlink. Are you aware of any of the details of that meeting and how many people attended, if it was attended by any of the residents?
There were three. It was held on November the 21st at Queen's Place. There's actually only three people showed up to that meeting.
Potential 35. If we approve this today, are we able to put the clause in there, the amendment that Councillor Fancy was talking about, to have reported back to us if the output of the tower changes in the future from what they're putting the application in for? Does that come into the agreement that is signed with Eastlink after we approve the tower going in, or is there something that needs to be amended now within the recommendation?
I think prior to getting, if Council is going to approve it, I want to do a little more work on that prior to see if that's actually something that we can legally put into the agreement.
Okay.
So I guess I'm not comfortable in saying, yes, we can throw that in there when it really can. So I'd want to investigate that further prior to that was the direction of Council that they wanted that inclusion. So.
CAO, did you have a comment?
I just want to caution Council that, the regulations, our planned regulations, allow for us to regulate substantial alterations to the development agreement, as Mr. McLeod said. And so technology changes every week, as we're all aware, and so my opinion would be if the technology changed next week and they change from the technology they're going to use today to another technology next week, it wouldn't be a substantial alteration. It's just an upgrade or maintenance to their existing tower. And so I want to caution Council not to put all their eggs in the basket about changing this technology is changing all the time, as we said, and so if other people go in there with other technologies on that tower, as was talked about, that people have the right to hook onto that same tower, it gets very complicated very quickly. And so we don't have any in-house expertise about whether a certain technology is appropriate or not appropriate on that tower or not on that tower. We're kind of putting all of our reliance on Industry Canada, who regulates it, understands the safety, who deal with Health Canada all the time on wind turbines and cell towers and internet towers and stuff. So we're kind of putting our reliance on them as although they are, someone suggested they're helping the companies rather than the consumer. I would hope that as fellow Canadians that they're helping consumers just as much as they're helping the companies as well and trying to have a balanced approach. So I just caution you not to hope by making a change that we're going to require them to come back to us, that it's going to be substantial enough that things are going to come back to us and you're going to be disappointed and upset, because a lot of those things I would suggest are just simply technology upgrades and not substantial changes to what they're asking for.
Okay, and I do agree that we do need to, as consumers, at some point put our faith into Environment Canada and Health Canada with their regulations.
And the comment was about going to 5G. Everybody's dreaming that they're going to get to 5G because it's going to give you much better cell service, much better wireless internet service and all those things. And so I don't know the health factors around 5G, but everybody in the world wants 5G.
Yeah.
Except the birds.
Except for the birds. And so, there's lots of studies out there. And so whether that was accurate or not, it's hard to tell. Just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's accurate.
Exactly. And there's so much information out there, and it's hard to understand. And I think that's why, unless you're willing to dedicate your life to, figuring out all the ins and outs of this and do the proper science behind it, that's why we do have to have faith in our Health Canada and Environment Canada. Just a little bit of research that I did, I understand that 5G networks are going to require far more towers than there are right now. So we'll have the opportunity to understand if that is going ahead, because we'll be obviously in the loop on erecting far more towers. And I think then there's more of a public engagement session going on there and more of a time to actually engage with the community and figure out more of the science behind this. And I also just want to point out that in the letter from Jeanette Georges is that she indicates it's that these studies were done people that lived within a 350 to a 400 meter radius, and we're only talking the nearest houses within a 700. Is it 700 feet?
700 feet. That's correct.
You're 700 feet, so that's closer than 300 to feet.
Yeah.
350 to 400 meters.
It's 220 meters or something.
Okay, Councilor McLeod?
None.
Okay. Councilor
Fancy? Still go back to the fact that, to me, and I understand this picking the farm or whatnot, I'm sure it's up here. I understand those kinds of things. But and I understand that whatever we say here today is going to make the hill of beans and what they're going to do, because they're going to do what they need to do, and whatever it may be. But I don't think that means that I should just say, okay, they're going to do what they're going to do, so I'm just going to forget about it and say, and say they're going to do what they're going to do anyway, and we'll just let it go. I just can't feel comfortable that way. I feel that we should know. I remember back microwaves first came out. Everybody's scared to death, going to get microwave death. But and who knows what that's all causing? And when somebody's making something from Ottawa saying that we're going to do something here and we're dying here and they're living there, it's that's a whole different kettle of fish. I don't know. And I think as council, I don't feel comfortable in knowing that they're going to make changes without coming back to us. And I cannot go ahead and just say, let them go and think that they know better than I do.
Thank you, Councilor Fancy. Any other councilor have a question or comment on this issue today? Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? We have 5 in favor. Those opposed? 3 opposed. It passes 5-3. Thank you very much, and thank you, Mike. So Moving on to 13.2, Mount Pleasant School proposal. Who would like to take the lead on 13.2? Counselor McLeod?
13.2, I move that the Council of the Region of Queens Municipality enter into a purchase and sale agreement with Queens Daycare Association for the sale of properties identified as PID numbers 7018-2902 and 7004-6792, known as the former Mount Pleasant School, for the purchase price of $1, and that a public hearing be held on January 8, 2019 at 9:00 a.m. in the Council Chambers of the Municipal Building, 249 White Point Road in Liverpool.
Seconded by Councilor Frehley. Mike, would you like to give us a briefing on this?
Yep. Just as you're all aware, Council in 2017 declared the former Mount Pleasant School as surplus to municipal needs and directed staff to begin a process to dispose of the property. So I guess from that, there was a request for proposals was sent out looking for submissions of interest in acquiring the property and building. The property is approximately 3 acres in area, with the former Mount Pleasant School being approximately 7,600 square feet in area. There's two parcels of land that are involved with this proposal. Under the Municipal Government Act, Council has the ability to convey municipal land, but the Act sets out that it has to be done at market value. But the Municipal Government Act also sets a provision whereby they can sell land to a non-profit organization that are carrying out the needs that are beneficial to the municipality. So with that, an appraisal was carried out in August to determine a value on that that property or those properties, and that came back at $69,000. So the request for proposals closed on November the 16th. There was only one proposal submitted. That was put in by the Queens Daycare Association for the purchase price of $1. In their submission, they outlined a number of community benefits, and in that the association has been located at the former Mount Pleasant School since 1984 and is carried out an important service to parents in Queens County over that that time. They provided work placement for students of early childhood education. They're employing local people in the operation. They also indicated that their willingness to collaborate with other community organizations in the use of the property and potential facility. So staff has had the opportunity to review the submission in detail. The Queens Daycare Association is a not-for-profit society under the Societies Act, so therefore council has the ability to consider the sale of this parcel of land to the group for less than market value and for $1. And council has in the past looked at the disposal of buildings such as former schools, the examples of the Milton Centennial School and the Mill Village School in the last few years, for the sale to those not-for-profit organizations for $1. So the recommendation of staff is that the properties be sold to the Queens Daycare Association for $1. The Municipal Government Act also sets out that where council is considering selling land under this section of the Municipal Government Act for less than market value, that a public hearing be held in order to get public input on the proposed sale. So so the recommendation includes a date and time for a public hearing in that regard. Just as a matter of note, after the recommendation was prepared, we were advised that the January 8th meeting is actually a night meeting scheduled for council, so the
recommendation goes forward, that the time be changed from 9 a.m. to, I believe, 6 p.m.
So as discussed, for a convenience of council, an amendment to change the time in the recommendation from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. would be something that we would consider at this point. Moved by Deputy Mayor Kelly, seconded by Councilor Fancy, that an amendment be made to the recommendation to change the 9 a.m. time to 6 p.m. on January the 8th. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Are you ready for the question on the
question?
All those in favor of the amendment? It is unanimous. Thank you. So now we have an amended motion, and we will entertain a discussion and questions on the amended motion. Councilor Fancy?
With this, of course, we're not talking about the sale yet, because we're talking about only as an approval of going forward with this to the public meeting. Any agreements we have within the body, is that follow along with the sale of the such as food banks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess with council's decision in 2017 to formally close the building, that the current tenants were given until the end of June of the 2019 to vacate the property. So any purchase and sale, I guess that's will be something that we would work out with them, because they are still in the building, and they, I believe, intend to be in the building until at least late spring. So any closure of the sale or the transaction, that would have to be scheduled around that June 30th date. So we would have to work with, both the Queens Daycare Association in drafting the purchase and sale, as well as the food bank as a current tenant of that, and work that into the purchase and sale agreement. So definitely something we'd have to take into consideration.
Yes, I have Deputy Mayor Kelly.
So what you're saying then is that even though this is before us today, depending on what happens, this wouldn't be finalized until June 30th, as when the region first put out the information that the building was going to be closing.
That's right. That's part. And I guess this is typically when we draft purchase and sales, we'll put a closing date for X number of months down the road. So this would be a little longer than will be typical of our transaction closures, but not uncommon. So so we would work with both of that, and it would be on or before that June 30th or July 1st or whatever date we come to an agreement on. So if the food bank was going to be out prior to that, then we could obviously close prior to. So that's something we'll have to work out in drafting the purchase and sale agreement.
CEO, you have a comment?
Just going to mention that. If this goes through and council approves this, then certainly we can have discussion with the potential new owner and the food bank about if the daycare needs it earlier, we might be able to expedite it and sell the property earlier with the purchase sale agreement saying that they're bound to continue to lease the property to the food bank for the next couple months until they're finished with the building. That allows them in earlier to do other renovations and stuff on their own part of the building, but also respect the terms and conditions of our agreement until June of 2019.
Now, with an RFP like this, you're always concerned about the ability of the not-for-profit to maintain the building, because as we've seen here earlier today, it comes back to the region to take care of whatever our residents or not-for-profits or businesses don't take care of them themselves. So obviously, we're giving it to them for a dollar. It's not always a great deal if they don't have the funds to maintain the building and bring it up to standards. So what's been in their proposal? How have they proposed to take care of the building, maintain the building, or fund the necessary repairs? And what is their intentions for the building?
Well, certainly there have been a number of things that were identified that were going to need some repair in the upcoming years, and that's one of the reasons council opted to dispose of the property. Now, it's my understanding that the group would be intending to work with another group or partner in upgrading or maintaining that building. But ultimately, when council conveys title, that will be their responsibility to for any cost.
They didn't outline any of that in their proposal.
They outlined that they were working with a partner who would be looking at some of the financial responsibilities of the upgrades to that building. So.
And their intentions for the properties?
That's to run the daycare essentially. Now they have indicated that they are willing to work with other groups like Plant the Plate and the community garden and things like that are presently on the property as well. So so they intend to work with those groups as well. So.
Thank you.
All right, Councilor Crowley.
This is a really good thing for Liverpool and part of my district, so I'm really, really pleased that hopefully we listen to their concerns rather than they're the only ones that put a bid in. Because we're talking about actual jobs, saving actual jobs. These are not alleged jobs, these are happening, so it's really important that we understand the importance of that. My only concern is the community garden. Is there any way to kind of include that in some sort of correspondence that we have a long-term commitment from them as part of the sale? Because I would hate to see anything happen with that relationship, leaving Plants to Blake's other puppet kind of in the air. So do we have that ability? Or is it back to once we pass it over, it's out of our hands?
The challenge becomes when you deed over a property and if they don't follow, say you put a covenant in and don't follow it, what's our recourse?
Yeah, nothing.
Our recourse is to go to court and sue them. And we're not going to do that.
Yeah, no, but it also sends a message that we're concerned about another nonprofit on the property. And as happy as we are, we'd be happier if they continue that partnership. So we may not follow up on it, but at least we're sending a message that it's important. So, and I don't know how we can do it.
I'd much rather put in a letter and encourage them to do that and recommend they do it as opposed to put it to agree that we're not.
That would be fine. That was my question. What can
yeah, something less formalized that you're looking at
yeah.
A separate agreement. Sure.
But thank you.
Follow up, Deputy Mayor Kelly?
Yes, well, that just brings up another question. You know, when we did the Mill Village School, we had the clauses in there that talked about, if they don't do what they say they're going to do and they don't, follow through with repairs and whatnot, that I guess it falls back to the region anyway. It's some lengthy process. But would we put any clauses in there as well that it reverts back to if they don't, reverts back to the region so that we could RFP it out again to another community group or to another buyer if they don't carry forth with their plans on the building or?
And I guess that is typically what we have done now, whether it's a buyback or turn back or an option of first right of refusal.
Right.
That's certainly potential.
Is that will be standard in our
and we certainly
now?
we certainly have in the past,
right.
Deputy Mayor, that
okay.
Including now Mill Village School, I think was a little bit different, but
yeah.
I guess the wording is always a little bit unique to the
yeah.
to the situation. But we typically would have a buyback condition.
Now the agreement, once it goes through the public hearing and agreement is written up, that comes back to council for approval, right?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
CA?
Just one comment. Buybacks are really bad public policy. We got front-footed now because once you put a clause in there and an organization or anybody has a property, even if it's a business, they always have that pushback that, well, if you don't give me what I want, you don't give me a grant or you don't give me a preference, I'm going to give it back to you. And it's going to be not in good condition. That's the problem we have now with the old schools, because the municipalities have essentially a buyback, they revert back. We get old schools that are in bad condition. And so it's, I'm suggesting it's bad public policy. Unless it's some very unique piece of property, we don't want to go there.
I understand.
And so this one we declare surplus, we don't need it. So for us to buy it back for a dollar and legal fees and all that stuff and then go through this whole process again, this group has it and they're gonna build a new building, do something different, then they should be able to sell it and take that money and apply it towards a new facility or something else, because they're gonna invest some time and effort in it. So if they go invest $100,000 in it next year, it wouldn't be appropriate for us to say, okay, well, if you don't continue, we're gonna get it back for a dollar. They're gonna wanna take that $100,000 investment they put into it, try to flip it and use it to build a new building or something like that.
Yeah, I hope so.
Councilor McLeod?
From your concerns about the buyback and all that, I really can't foresee any issue with that. We had a group here at council, last council meeting, who were really, really wanting that facility. It's something that I think is working out well in everybody's favor. And I know that Donna and her committee and her partner will do whatever they can to do the renovations and work it out and grow that operation. I'm hoping with this building and the fact that they will be able to eventually have the full use of it, that the province will be very supportive if they want to have the opportunity to bring in younger age children, because right now it's 18 months and older. So now that may be an opportunity where they can apply to the province to be able to have daycare services for younger children, so that parents have an opportunity for great daycare. So I think it's wonderful it's happening, and they've worked hard at this. And I know we certainly are doing the right thing in passing this on for the dollar. And I know that in the past we've done this for other organizations, and we've had very success with most of them, all of them. But the Debbie School in Mill Village is amazing. They've done wonderful things. They've been involved in our community. And that was, they were an unknown organization. This daycare has been operating for I don't know how many years. And they're very highly respected, and I think this is going to be great for them.
Thank you. Any other councilor have a question or comment on this issue? So we are now going to, I'm going to ask for a question on the motion as amended. Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? It is unanimous. Thank you. So, thank you, Mike. We'll move on now to 13.3, Caledonia Bus Garage Proposal. Who would like to take the lead on this recommendation? Councilor Johnson?
Okay, I'd like to recommend the council that the Council of the Region of Municipality enter into a purchase and sale agreement with Robert A. Cole for the sale of the property identified as PID number 701-54695, known as the former Caledonia School Bus Garage, for the purchase price of $151,000.
Second to that, Councilor Fisk. Mike, would you like to give us a brief update?
Yes, this particular property at 9692 Highway in Caledonia, it's commonly known as the former school bus garage. The lot is actually a fairly significant parcel of land within the core area of Caledonia. It's 5.5 or a little better acres, plus the circa 1995 building. So it's fairly recent building that's located on the property. In August of 2018, the school board gave notification to the municipality that they were no longer going to be utilizing this building for school bus service. So the property and any interest that they had in that property was reverting back to the municipality. So the municipality did an evaluation and determined that there was no future municipal need for that, and that staff was directed to again begin the process to look at disposing of this parcel of land and building. So as with the previous, the Municipal Government Act sets out the council can sell that at market value. Property Valuation Services has the land valued or assessed at $144,000. We also prepared or had a professional real estate appraisal company prepare an appraisal on the property, and that came back at $348,000. A request for proposal was sent out, as with the Mount Pleasant School, and I'm looking for proposals to purchase the property, and that again closed on November the 16th. There were three proposals submitted.
one by Robert Cole Plumbing and Heating for the purchase price of $151,000. They outlined that their proposal would allow for expansion of existing commercial business that is located in the North Queens area, and it would allow that commercial business better access to internet and cellular services at this location. There's future employment opportunities. They're looking at expanding their business, and just the purchase price, it had the greatest financial benefit to the taxpayers of Queens. Submitter number two was RSR Machining and Fabrication. Their proposal was for $50,000. The community benefits that they had would be allowed for expansion of an existing commercial business that's located in the North Queens area, as well as future employment opportunities should the business expand. The current business participates in a student work program for students in the North Queens High School. They RSR Machining also indicated that they would donate a current 26 by 60 building, which is located on their adjacent parcel of land, to the local ground search and rescue, and they estimate that to have a value of $20,000. The third submitter was George Ullman for a purchase price of $10,000. He would be proposing to provide a vehicle bay for the storage North Queens ground search and rescue vehicle, whilst potentially the establishment of a recycling depot, potentially a vehicle service station repair shop. Mr. Ullman would also like to create a multi-purpose recreational area behind the garage, like a skating rink or a playground or skate park, and that there also may be some future employment opportunities. So now, as owner, current owner of the property, that what was former the responsibility of the school board or South Shore School Board, that the cost for maintaining that building will now be the responsibility of the municipality. So we will certainly be required to incur costs if we keep the parcel in under municipal ownership. I guess staff are of the opinion that the sooner we can get the property into private hands, would be certainly in the best interest of the taxpayers of Queens. With this, the monies that we see from the sale of this parcel can be utilized in other areas of the municipality, and the property would actually be generating some tax revenue. While the appraisal indicated a value of $348,000, the open public process that we went through with the issuance of the request for proposal is also considered a fair indicator of what the market value is in a particular area, and it's actually maybe more accurate to a particular area as far as what the community is willing to pay, a particular community is willing to pay for a property. So with a review of all three submissions, it's the opinion of staff that the proposal of Robert A. Cole for the purchase from the price of $151,000 is fair, reasonable, and would be in the best interest of the taxpayers of Queens.
Any councillor have a question or comment on this? Councillor Johnson?
Just, I got a question and a couple of comments. First of all, Mike, on the diagram that's on the item, it shows encroachment there, the medical center onto this property. Is that accurate?
That's the mapping is a graphic representation. Oh, I don't know whether that's actually been surveyed or that. Yeah.
But the other side of it is that I know that the one that's in front of us for approval for $151,000 was a little bit lighter on the community benefits summary. Mm-hmm. But in light of what we just passed for some opportunity for grant money, the sale of this property being $80,000, when you figure the second submitter put in $20,000 for that other building, that gets us $80,000 to work with and do the other thing. The timing on this really stinks in light of the fact that we've lost our gas station as of yesterday.
Oh,
the only fuel station in
decision has been made today at this point, would it be the responsibility of our staff to ensure that Keith is still on in that building at the present time?
It's not, and I think we'll have to look at whether we winterize, getting that winterized as far as the plumbing and stuff like that, definitely so.
So that will be addressed by staff. Any other council have a question or comment? Councilor Fisk?
I'm just very pleased that the RFP came in three different categories, and I'm very pleased for the Robert Cole to step up the plate, and I believe you'll see that Robbie will expand his business to a much larger commercial type of business, and will create some employment there. I realized that he needed internet access to the location he is now. It's not very good for internet service, so I applaud Robbie for this, so thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Fisk. Any other councilor have a question or comment? Councilor Fancy?
My only question was is what Councilor Johnson had put forward. I know there's no power there, so have we been inside to make sure that everything is... Because I don't think it's been cold enough yet to freeze things up, but just to make sure that everything is, we aren't going to be leaving something that's going to be a problem for somebody else.
I would expect we will not, but I would ask Mike if you have any comments.
Yeah, no, it hasn't been recently that we've been out to the building, but we'll have our works department go out and inspect that, and whatever winterization is necessary for that.
I would think the condition of purchase and sale would require an inspection.
I would, yeah.
Any other councilor have a question or comment? Yes, Councilor Chris?
Furthering on to Gil's comments on the service station, that it is a very serious matter in North Queens right now.
It is Councilor Fisk, but not a matter of this issue.
I know, but
we certainly do appreciate the gravity of that.
Yeah,
I know
sure.
That Councilor Johnson has been asking some questions to see if there's a solution to this, as will the Region of Queens do what it can within our ability to resolve that as well. So back to the issue before us, which is the school bus garage in North Queens. Any other questions or comments of councilors on this issue? Are you ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of the motion? It is unanimous. Thank you. So we have nothing under 14.0 reports, nothing under 14.0 in camera. And I would ask, yes, just one second.
Can I go?
Yeah, Mike, if you would remain, because I had one question regarding 16.0, if you would be prepared to do 16.0 at this time.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Councilor Kelly?
Oh, that's okay. I just wanted, when you skipped over reports, I should have said something, but I just wanted to let everybody know about an event going on this weekend.
Very quickly.
Downtown for the holidays is happening this Saturday for the benefit of everybody that's in the gallery and the rest of the counselors. I passed out posters to everybody, and it's we started it last year with part of Christmas on the Mersey, and this year Christmas in Queens, which encompasses three weekends to try to bump up Christmas spirit and economic development in Liverpool. And Brian Castle Frelick and myself have taken on board this event, where there will be about 33 events, activities going on between Main Street and Bristol Avenue, all through Liverpool, for families to come out and enjoy a great day on December the 1st between 10 and 4 p.m. All kinds of activities going on. It's on Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor Kelly. We will move on now, Mike, 16.0.
If you could, I have set up a PowerPoint presentation. If we could break for maybe a couple of minutes to allow me.
We will recess for 5 minutes. Thank you. Do you know if you know? We will resume council meeting. Mike, you have a presentation?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
We will resume with 16.0, Planning and Development Department overview.
Yeah, I guess this is just an update or an overview of the Planning and Development Department, outlining a little bit of what we do, the processes that are involved in some of the things that we deal with on the on a day-to-day basis, and it's a fairly lengthy list, and I tried to include most of the detail within the overview of the department that was just distributed to you. So as far as the mandate of the Planning and Development Department, our essential tasks are to provide direction and leadership in relation to land use planning, community development, and bylaw administration to ensure that the region of Queens evolves in a manner which sees orderly, healthy, and sustainable development of our communities. And there it is. So that's, an umbrella context of really what the responsibilities of the Planning and Development Department are to the municipality. Now, the department currently is made up of six full-time staff members, myself being the director, Wendy Connors, who's agreed to sit up here with me as development officer and looks after a lot of the things when I'm not around as far as operation of the department. Rely on her quite heavily. The planning and development technician, Colin Van Buskirk, who looks after more of the most of the technical details of the department. Bill Layton, he's our bylaw and fire official. Kellyanne Hurley is our bylaw enforcement officer. And of course, Christine Watson provides administrative assistance to all of our department as well as some with the Works Department and her direct involvement with council proceedings, minutes, and things like that as well. So, so within the hierarchy of the department, I just prepared a little chart of this. Council is probably fairly well aware that the. We do all our reporting ultimately to the mayor and council of the region of Queens. I report directly to Chris McNeil, our chief administrative officer, and I, as the director of the department, look after the operation of the department, being a development officer, technician, building fire official, bylaw enforcement officer, and administrative assistant. So with the operation of operation of the department, we provide services to quite a number of individuals and groups, obviously council and other regional staff, but we work with various external organizations, other government agencies, like the Land Registration Office. We work with lawyers, surveyors, property valuation services. We provide information and have considerable interaction with many groups and organizations, and of course we provide information assistance, obviously, to the general public. Considerable amount of our time is spent answering questions, looking after requests of information from the general public. So, so really, it's the role of staff of the Planning Department to review, research, and report to Council on any matter related to land use planning and development, as well as bylaw enforcement, in assisting Council in making the necessary decisions that it has to make. So, so ultimately, we report to you as Council. So, department responsibilities and processes. There's a considerable list of responsibilities and processes that we attend to on a daily basis. And I've outlined, as I said, most of those within the document. So we'll start off with land use planning. As you're all aware, all of Queens County is now currently regulated with a municipal planning strategy and land use bylaw, and has been since 2009 as a regional documents. The documents establish goals, objectives, policies, and regulations for how we want to see the community develop over the next 10, 15, 20 years. So the existing documents were approved by Council in 2009,
And as set out in policy and the planning strategy that we, and required under the Municipal Government Act, that we're required to do mandatory reviews of the documents every few years. So as you're all aware, we're currently in that process of reviewing and revising the Municipal Planning Strategy and Land Use Bylaw. But outside of the formal review, there are going to be times within between the terms of formal reviews of the planning documents where we need to do amendments to the planning strategy and or land use bylaw. So I've outlined some of the steps that are involved, and we're all fairly well familiar. We've done a fair number of amendments to the documents during this term of council. But the general process for amendments to the planning documents is that application is submitted, staff reviews the application to ensure that all the necessary information is included, and then a report is prepared by staff for a planning advisory committee to review. PAC reviews that and makes a recommendation to council. Council reviews and if approved sets a date for a public hearing. Provincial legislation sets out the process that we have to follow respecting any amendments to the planning documents, and that they require the holding of a public hearing, as well as necessary advertising to inform the public that the public hearing is taking place. So so we have the public hearing. Council has its review and discussion following the public hearing. If approved by council, then amendments are sent off to the province for review in the case of a municipal planning strategy, which is the policy document. If it's just a land use bylaw amendment, it doesn't have to go to the province, so therefore it's a little bit shorter process. So I guess the municipal planning strategy and land use bylaw, the processes are essentially the same, with the exception of sending the documents to municipal planning amendments to the director of planning, provincial director of planning, for review. So 3 to 4 month process to go through for the amendments to the strategy or bylaw. The other process, as we've seen this morning, is the development agreement process, which essentially mirrors the process we go through for an amendment to the planning strategy and land use bylaw. With the exception that once approved by council and notification is placed in the paper that we have to record that document. A development agreement is a legal agreement that gets recorded against a parcel of land and gets recorded at the Registry of Deeds, so that any future purchaser of that property is bound by the same terms of that agreement as the original as the original owner of the property. So again, about a 3 month process to go through. Variance applications. The land use bylaw sets out basically the regulations around what can and can't develop on a parcel of land. Sets out the permitted uses. It sets out setbacks from property lines, minimum lot sizes, and that sort of thing. Under the Municipal Government Act, there are certain provisions that they've incorporated to allow council to consider variances in some of these requirements to allow flexibility within the planning documents. If somebody wanted to construct a new building on a property and couldn't meet the required setbacks, they have the ability to apply for a variance in that. They apply to Wendy. Wendy reviews that and says, yeah, that meets the requirements of the land use bylaw for consideration of a variance. Then a notification letter gets sent out to all property owners within 200 feet of the subject property, just advising them that a variance has been applied for, and that if they object, they can make their objection before council and come before council and say why they don't feel that a variance should be granted in this certain circumstance. And so if somebody appeals, we set time at probably the next council meeting, and they can come before council and say why they feel that the variance should be granted. But we haven't had too many of those, maybe two or
two appeals.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not something that's very common. But it just the variance allows for a degree of flexibility in the regulations under the land use bylaw.
Are we able to ask?
Yes, Councilor.
And when do you understand where I'm coming from with this? Because I just had personal experiences where I didn't have to apply for variance, but I just have a question about that part of our planning documents. I can understand a variance with property lines, okay? You're too close to somebody else's property line. But I was rather surprised, Wendy knows where I'm coming from. I had a garage close to my house, and I built the deck, but the deck couldn't be any closer than 10 feet
from
whatever.
All. Yeah.
So, I mean, how is that going to affect somebody in my neighboring property? Why would I have to apply for a variance for that? I know it's in our documents, but why would someone on their own property, which has no effect on anybody else's property, have to apply for a variance within the confines in their own property?
I guess it's a generally used provision within, I think you look at emergency service provision and fire services or some place, something like that has to access that. There's adequate separation, or if there's a fire in your garage, that's not easily jumping to your dwelling or vice versa. There's, I guess, maintaining that separation distance, I guess, allows for a degree of safety, if you will, and that's generally.
Are you required to include that in, or that's just our choice to do that in our documents?
That would be a choice within our documents, yeah. That's right. Yeah, and it is within our documents, and it always has been, and I think that's kind of the rationale behind that there's from more of an emergency service type in a garage in particular, that you don't get that fire jump. The things can be stored within a garage, and that's kind of the rationale behind that. And so we established that at 10 feet, which is generally accepted.
I think it's ridiculous myself, that short, certain, I mean, here it is a distance, you know, like within your own.
It's always ridiculous when it affects you directly,
you
doesn't it?
And I went through the rules, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess
but it is. And I had to reconfigure my whole deck. It cost me like $500 more to do it in order to stay the 2 extra feet that I needed. Interesting, because you don't want to make any financial hardships on people to expand or to do their own within their own confines of their own property. That's, I mean, it is. It's kind of.
Do you store gasoline, propane,
no.
Barbecue, any of that stuff in your garage?
In my garage, no, my barbecue. My barbecue's on my back deck.
Which is now close to your garage.
Yeah.
Right?
No, it
is. It could have been.
No, my barbecue. No.
As Mike said, the issue is most people store their lawnmower, their gas,
mm-hmm.
oil, their
sure.
lawn, or their propane things in their garage. And so if you had an explosion there,
yeah.
and it's so close to your deck, your barbecue's on your deck, and it explodes, you get your barbecue, which then explodes, your house is gone. So
that's
we're trying to protect you from yourself, from not putting all these combustibles too close to each other.
But yet we don't have any variance to say that when you build a house, your garage has to be separate from your house, because houses are built where the garage is attached.
Yeah.
Only if they want them to be a separate
yeah.
garage, then it has to be.
Where do they store their
yeah. probably a firewall.
Yeah. And that's right, under
yeah.
National Building Code standards, there's
a garage and a house?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, definitely so. So.
Yeah, I have Councilor Johnson had a question.
Well, I just, this whole piece of variance and stuff like that, and I know you have rules, and I know it.
It's affecting all of us.
I know.
Well, okay, so there's 8 people in this room. We got 10,000 people in the community.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill's still here.
11 people. But to that end, at the last council meeting, I heard something that I really liked, and it's the strategy of why do you want to live here and what keeps people from living here. And that is a common thread that needs to
yeah.
run through mm-hmm. every department. So when we're talking about variances, you know, if there's a variance, great. But tell me why and how it applies to my situation, and I can ramble
people parked in the parking garage with oil, gas, and the fuel tank.
Well, that, and that's a case in point. That's, I guess, potential for danger to your dwelling. And that's, I guess, the rationale for the separation at some point. So.
But if you're putting in a garage in your house, there's a fire separation. Mm-hmm. There's no fire separation for an outbuilding in your deck for your house. So there is a higher degree when you put the garage in your house.
But you're allowed to park your car
so
right
keeps
next to your house.
It.
So what
I
you
may
warms
have
up,
a
Councilor
Johnson
to
see if he has any more.
Well, all I'm commenting on is I really like what Chris and the economic development people presented as kind of a strategic document, and to make sure that it is interdepartment driven, that the question is why do you want to live here? And how many people have we heard to say, well, I don't want to go to Queens because it's so hard to do this, it's so hard to do that. Yeah, it's out there. That's all I'm saying. I'm just making a comment. I'm not judging or anything.
And I think that's a fair comment to Councilor Johnson, that we want to make regulations. You're regulating for the minority. And essentially, that's what it is. But I guess you regulate for a reason. Now, most municipalities are regulated through varying degrees through their municipal planning strategy and land use bylaw. There's not that many that aren't. And sometime in the near future, all municipalities, I expect, will have some minimum standard of land use planning in place. So I think you have to reevaluate that stuff if there's complications. But regulations are a necessity, but what degree of regulation, I think we need to continually evaluate and make sure that they're current with
this stuff.
Well, and that's a good example, that you're regulating for that small minority, but unfortunately it's a necessity to ensure that we develop in a way that's attractive to people that want to move here, that's reasonable to the people that currently live here. You have to find that balance, and that's not always an easy thing.
So, like I said, I'm not judging. I'm just.
But it's a great discussion because we're in the perfect position right now with our review to actually change or, you know, modify anything that's in our MPS or above that we don't think works for us because we're looking at the next 10 years. What does life in Queens County look like in 10 years' time, and how is it affecting the way we live here right now and for the next 10 years? So it's perfect.
No, it is, and they're meant to be living documents. Things change over time. We don't have that crystal ball to say what's coming down the pipe in a couple of years down the road, even. So it's they're meant to evolve over time, and if things aren't working, we fix them.
And we have 10 years of experience to see what's not working.
That's
so,
right. No, absolutely.
You know,
that's it. The 2009 documents were a first cut at a regional, regional documents, and there was a lot of compromise. Had to go into those to get the documents established at that time, and it's there'll be a lot of things that will change from the current documents into the new documents. So. We want to be progressive. We don't want to be overly restrictive, but some restriction is necessary. So,
Councilor Frill?
I'm just looking at this, what you have on the screen, and there's a lot of what you do, and that's good information, and we all have that in front of us. But I found in the last two things, we're talking about the future and the things that, you know, I want to know how you feel about the future and the things that we're missing out. And, you know, it's kind of a prelude to what they're talking about with the planning document, but you know, since we're talking about the things that we're bitter about,
that's later in the presentation.
Yeah.
So we're going to go through all of.
And I can quickly, I guess. There's no sense in touching on every little process, but I know, and that's really the meat and the potatoes of what you're here today for, is to see what's coming down. So I guess just some of the other things that we deal with. Subdivision, the municipality is responsible for approving or rejecting plans of subdivision, which includes consolidating lots within all of Queens County. So they come into Wendy. Wendy evaluates those on our subdivision bylaw and either approves or
advise them based on the regulations. Building inspection services, Bill Leitner is our building inspector. He's a certified level 2 inspector who conducts all building inspections for the municipality. He's also our fire inspector. So Bill looks after the building permit applications. He also looks after applications for mobile homes as well as demolition permits to ensure the demolitions and the materials that are generated from demolitions are disposed of in a proper manner. So say fire inspections, Bill is also responsible for. Kellyanne is responsible, obviously, for bylaw enforcement, looking at majority of the bylaws that the council certainly currently has in place. Some of the primary duties look at dog control, parking control, working with Scott in solid waste management, and enforcement of the provisions under the under the solid waste bylaw. And of course, dangerous and unsightly premises as set out under the MGA that council has the ability to regulate the state of parcels, the exterior parcels of land within its jurisdiction. So Kellyanne spends probably the majority of her time looking after this aspect of her duties. So very time consuming. Civic ed dressing, municipality is responsible for assigning civic numbers. We have a civic numbering bylaw, which Colin assists Kellyanne in enforcing. We have pretty good compliance with the requirement for civic number signs, posting civic number signs within Queens County, but it's something that we still continue to work on, those that don't, but the bulk of certainly the majority of parcels within Queens County are in compliance with city government bylaw. Colin looks after updating their GIS or mapping software and databases, the attribute databases. We do all our own work internally. Creation of databases, map creation. You've all seen some of the products that we've prepared with our system. So it's a system we've had the town originally incorporated GIS within the planning department back in 1994, and it's currently evolved to a significant tool that we use on a day-to-day basis in our operation. And I don't know how actually we'd operate without the GIS, going back to the hard copy maps that they used to do years ago. So,
like civic numbers, at the end of the road we live on, they put a civic number there, but it's a mile from where the guy lives. How does that work? I don't understand. The guy lives off the grid, way back in the woods, and they put a civic number right at the cul-de-sac. But
it must be because that's the end of the travel surface.
So yeah. Essentially, that's private property, I guess, going beyond the cul-de-sac. So there's no, unless they establish a private road that leads from the end of the cul-de-sac a mile back.
And he probably has a number back there as well.
He does, I think.
Just to help the fire department at least get.
Yeah.
To the start.
Okay, and that's what I was going to say. Like, if you got called for a fire and you see that number there, well, you'd be looking for the dwelling, I think.
Yes.
Not always.
There's always those little anomalies. It's just that typically a civic number is assigned by where a driveway intersects with a public or
yep.
private road. In this case, that's essentially his driveway going from the end of the cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
Back.
Okay,
there's a couple of those. There's no perfect system, but I guess you've got to do. I know we've we're working, or Colin has been working with Nova Scotia Power to civic number some of the dams that are located like 30 miles back.
Yeah.
In the woods.
In the woods, so we're kind of working with the DNR, and our Colin is with DNR and Nova Scotia Power to try to assign, appropriately assign civic addresses to these, but there's always some challenges in whatever system, but.
I've just never seen that before.
Yeah.
I've seen it the other night, and I'm thinking, why would they have a civic number?
And I think placed at the end of the cul-de-sac is necessary that emergency services might not go beyond the end of the cul-de-sac, so I think they need that at that location, and then they would continue on up the road, but.
Councilor Chris?
Just to follow up on the civic number, when you get in an area, I'm gonna pick on an area such as LaBelle, a lot of private roads, a lot of private people that don't wanna be found, so they don't put a civic number up. That's not our responsibility, that's theirs.
Well, no, ultimately it is, well, it is a responsibility of.
Well, I mean, if the place burns down and because the fire department put it in there, but it's good for the civic number, why would it be, why would we be held responsible?
Under the bylaw, I guess the owner of a property that has a building located on that is responsible for erecting a proper civic number sign under the bylaw, so if a proper number is not in place, and as Kellyanne or Colin are driving around, or we receive complaints that there's no civic address, we investigate, and Kellyanne or Colin would drop off a copy of the bylaw to the individual, setting out that it is responsibility, and you can be fined, was it $50 or something like that, I think is the minimum fine for non-compliance, but for a $25 sign, and the ability of emergency service providers to find yours, it's really a no-brainer, but some people still.
Well,
and we depend on.
I put a civic number, because I wouldn't fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We depend on some of the fire departments, too, to let us know if they can't find civic, like, there's certain civic addresses that aren't up, they'll sometimes let Colin know of that, so.
Yeah, and I think there have been discussions, particularly with the Greenfield Fire Department, for, I guess, pockets of that are lacking in civic numbers, and we address it as we can, but I think if there's.
Well, all they do now is if they see smoke, go to it.
Councilor Chris?
That's enough.
Could, I would say sometimes thoughts off the top of the head aren't the best ones, but when I look at it and I say, if a house isn't visible from the road, if it's too far off the road, I think if somebody was going there for either a fire, for someone was hurt or something, and you're going there as an emergency, and you start back the road and get back far enough, you say, I'm on the wrong road. Is this, I don't know. Could they be colored differently? That anything would be too far off of it. So if it's something like it was number 17, it was a red color, you know, at least it's gonna be 500 or, you know, so many feet off. So people don't just get driving back and think like, I'm on the wrong road, and come back out and do not attend to what it could be.
Now, emergency services are all tied into the Nova Scotia Civic Addressing File, the NASCAF, which has all the roads, the listed public and private roads within the province, and the civic address points. So, how many? It's been quite a few years ago that the province went through and did the civic addressing points.
Yeah.
So, I guess all that information is in the system now, and then any new civic addresses that come up, Colin actually goes out and GPSs that information. But when you have a property or structure that's way back, you can't see it from the road, there are provisions under the civic numbering bylaw that set it where you have to place your sign. If you can't clearly see a civic number sign posted on the front of a structure, then you have to post it out by the road so that the emergency service providers can easily see the civic number and know that that's the proper location. So
I just hate to see somebody starting back a road and then they rip, like I've gone back way too far. I'm on the wrong road.
Usually the civic address is right up there.
But Kevin was saying, you know, if I live a mile back in the road,
we had a red sign, you know, that you could say, well, we know we're on the right road, it's gonna be a back here way.
Yeah, but if they get to this, if the proper civic number is posted at the front of the road, they should keep driving till they find the structure, so.